Welcome back to The Bonfire, where we talk about the UFC and mixed martial arts. I am your host, Mike Bon, and it is finally here, folks. It is UFC 309 Fight Week. John Jones makes his return to the octagon after more than 20 months away for what could be his career finale against Stipe Miocic for the heavyweight title. Co-main event is a rematch at lightweight between Charles Oliveira and Michael Chandler. The drama around this card is already building, especially over the past few days, courtesy of some very polarizing comments from one John Jones. He does this interview with Kevin Ioli, a few others, and pretty much says that he has no interest and that Tom Aspinall is not worthy of a unification fight with him if he comes out victorious, and instead mentions that Alex Pereira is the only fight of appeal for him left on the UFC roster. They could even do it without a title on the line at heavyweight, maybe indicating he would give up his belt and allow Aspinall to assume the position as undisputed champion. Like many others out there, I can't say I love this. It's going to be really interesting to see how this week unfolds and what happens. If Jones wins and decides not to retire and wants the Pereira fight, I truly do think he needs to give up that heavyweight belt. He's continuously daring Aspinall to enhance his resume and his legacy. And it's kind of hard to do that if someone else is holding the belt hostage and you're stuck as the interim champion and he won't fight you. The big problem with that, however, is that I don't really see any appeal for Jones versus Pereira if there's no heavyweight title on the line. If that fight happens, I want to see Pereira going up to try to become the first fighter in UFC history to win titles in three weight classes. And if that opportunity isn't there and it's just a regular fight, I don't know if Jones would consider going back down to 205 or if he could do that. But even then, it doesn't have the same upside for Pereira, for the UFC. And it's more or less just a fight for Jones to try to put a fan favorite and someone who's doing well in Pereira on his resume. So we will see how all this unfolds. Perhaps, as Daniel Cormier has suggested, this is all just a big ploy by Jones to drive up the price from the UFC for an Aspinall fight. If that's what he's doing, more power to him. It's brilliant. But if it's not, there's a lot of questions to be asked about how this late career play by Jones could impact his legacy in the sport. And that's just the reality. But the time will come to talk about all that type of stuff throughout fight week, see what else is said, see what else comes. But today, we are focusing on something a little bit different. This UFC 309 card, maybe not the deepest in terms of talent and marquee names as some other pay-per-views, but this thing has got a lot of historical figures involved. This card has the fighters with the UFC records for most title fight wins, most fights, most finishes, most submissions, and most bonuses. Given that, I thought there was no better time to have the research analyst from UFC Stats, previously known as Fight Metric, Mr. Michael Carroll, my good friend, on here to talk about the statistical side of these fights and this card. If you don't know about Michael, truly one of the greater minds in MMA from a statistical and data processing standpoint, putting things into context. Anyone who followed my career up to this point has known my great passion for stats as well. So I thought this was a great meeting of the minds and a lot of great topics hit on in relation to UFC 309. So Michael and I will discuss some key record holders, the potential history at play, and more at UFC 309. Please make sure to like, subscribe, follow, comment, or whatever you do as a show of support for this program on whatever platform you are consuming it on. It means a lot. We will take a quick break and then we'll be right back with Michael Carroll. And we are back with one of my very favorite people in the sport, as I mentioned, Michael Carroll, UFC stats research analyst, formerly known as Fight Metric to some of your old heads out there. Mike, man, thank you for joining the Bonfire for the first time. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I'm honored to be a part of this on one of such the early episodes. I wanted to begin things with saying Fight Cove, never die. Yeah. And I'm happy to be here. It's really good to see you. We used to see each other every once in a while when I was on the road and you were on the road. And it's been a little while because of COVID and other things, but it's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, that pre-COVID era, man. It's like, it's almost crazy to think about, like, just different city every single week on the road. I know that's what people are like desperately wanting them to go back to now. It's almost hard to think like to even go back to that. I don't know if I'd be capable of what we were doing pre-COVID.
Yeah, it was quite a grind. I was on the road at least a few times a month. I did pretty much every North American show. And then whenever pay-per-views went international, I'd probably be at those too. And I did that for about 7 years before COVID kicked in. And we figured out how to do most of what I do remotely. Mm-hmm. So I don't travel anymore, but I do miss it sometimes. It is a grind sometimes. And I miss the crew. The UFC crew is a tight group and they work their butts off. And yeah, those are great people. And it takes a lot out of you to be on the road a lot. I know you've been you've had quite a few stretches of time on the road yourself. You're still out there a lot anyway. So
Yeah, man. I guess before we get into UFC 309 a little bit, tell me about that transition you guys made from, you know, being at every event and having to input statistics, and whether it's in fight or after the fact, to what evolved to having to be, you know, remote like everyone was during COVID. And it seems like you guys found some good ways and some good, you know, paths to tracking data there. So I guess what was that transition phase like?
Well, like most everybody, it was a bit chaotic at first. We didn't know quite what to do, but we saw it as a group, as an opportunity to challenge ourselves, to get creative, and to try to solve a big task quickly, and to see how we could go forward with this. If we wanted to go back to the old ways, once we assumed the world would open up the way that it was pre-COVID, which it has, or if we wanted to kind of do a hybrid of some of the old and some of the new. And I think that's where we're at now. During COVID, we would travel far fewer people, as you would expect, and we figured out how to do a lot of what we do remotely. And now we have a good mix of people on site who do certain tasks, and then other people remotely who can stay remote and still get the job done at a really great level still. And I'm one of those people, so yeah.
Yeah, and of course, you can, you know, anyone who may not be the most familiar with what we're talking about, you can go to ufcstats.com. And of course, you know, you see these things referenced on all the broadcasts, whether it's an in-fight statistic or, you know, live tracking of data and stuff like that. What have you guys changed from like tracking those measurements? Because I know like very early on, I remember like seeing some joystick type machinery that you guys would use. And I don't know what you do now. Like, has there been a big evolution in, I guess, the tracking process, or is it just being made easier by having a bigger group of people working on it?
Not much has changed in terms of the way that we implement things, the way that we try to tabulate what and do what we do. And I would say that the mix of people on the road and people that are, well, at home or local, I think it's never been a smoother process than now. We really haven't changed a whole lot in terms of what happens during a fight, but setting things up for the events, that's really where things have differed. And that's not my particular area of expertise, because I'm still sitting on my butt at home.
Right.
But yeah, we've established a greater, I would say, umbrella of technicians and people who are real experts at what they do. And yeah, we've never really been doing our work better, I don't think.
That's awesome, man. No, you guys obviously are a huge part of the UFC product and very important for people like myself. And I thought this was just such a fitting card to have you on to talk, because UFC 309, I mean, you look up and down, maybe not like the deepest card in terms of ranked fighters or marquee matchups, but if you look at record holders, they're pretty much all there except for the Black Beast, Derek Lewis, with the KO record. We got the record holder in John Jones for most title fight wins, most fights and wins, Jim Miller, and then most finishes, submissions, and bonuses in Charles Oliveira, who competes in the co-main event. I feel like we need to start at the top, though. Obviously, John Jones versus Stipe Miocic. We've been waiting about 20 months for this fight. I think that's what it was when Jones beat Ciryl Gane. We're finally getting it now. And obviously, John comes into this as second heavyweight fight. We didn't have much data to go off from the debut in Ciryl Gane, right? But I'm curious with you, like, is there anything for Jones as a heavyweight that you find noticeable or tangible or anything like that compared to at heavyweight, even though it's only a couple minutes, or light heavyweight rather?
Well, yeah, again, we only have a couple minutes of action with him at heavyweight. And that fight, if I recall to the best of my ability, was sort of over before it even began. It was a couple of minutes of feeling each other out. There was a clinch, and then all of a sudden somebody's tapping and the fight's over. Okay, John Jones did it again. I think what we could learn from that is that Jones could be particularly more dangerous as a grappler at heavyweight than he was at light heavyweight, especially in the most recent years. A first round submission doesn't happen in a championship fight very often. In fact, that was just one of 15 such finishes in UFC history. I think it was the fourth or fifth since 2016. So they just don't happen very much. And at heavyweight in particular, they really don't. You have to go back to the days of Tim Sylvia getting tapped out in the first by Frank Mir and Andrei Arlovsky. Yeah, I think those are the only three that have ever happened in the first round in a heavyweight championship fight. So maybe Jones has something special in terms of grappling at heavyweight that heavyweights just can't keep up with. Gane was, you know, served up as one of the young new killers that was really well-rounded, could kickbox and grapple and kind of do it all. And Jones just sort of went right through him before we even knew what happened.
Yeah. Do you think, because a lot of it is being made of that performance, right? Some people say Ciryl Gane just laid an egg in that fight. what do you kind of side with? Because we saw, of course, the Francis Ngannou fight that exposed some defensive flaws in Ciryl Gane's grappling, and then Jones went out there and took advantage of it very quickly. Is that like a fair thing to say about Ciryl Gane, that, you know, he does have that flaw there and it's being exposed, or do you think maybe too much is being made of that?
I mean, you could say that he has that flaw. You could also say too much is being made of it, because he went in there and fought the greatest fighter perhaps right. we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Someone who's a fantastic wrestler, an excellent grappler, and doesn't have to change from mode to mode before our very eyes. He just does it. He just is, you know. He can strike and grapple and wrestle, and we don't see him have to change. So I think Gane maybe went in there a little too fast. Maybe he wasn't quite ready and up for the task of a John Jones fight. Yeah. But I don't think there were any regrets with the matchmakers. I think that fight had to happen, and it was they were both worthy of being in there.
Of course, yeah, no, they were the right fights to make given the circumstances. You know, obviously, mm-hmm. if things had been different, certain contracts, things that we don't necessarily deal with, maybe we get different fights. But you mentioned there, you know, we saw how quickly John was able to take advantage of Ciryl, but you sent me the stat in relation to John Jones. He's just 7-for-20 on takedown attempts in his last four fights. What do you read into that? Of course, it worked well for him at heavyweight, but Stipe Miocic, as we know, is a stronger, more proven wrestler than Ciryl Gane. So is that something that you kind of have your eye on, that 7-for-20, and seeing, does that lower success rate of takedowns carry into this fight, or is, you know, just completely different matchup? What do you read into that?
I think in recent years, Jones has really set one item up to have the other find success. So he struggled in a couple of recent, primarily kickboxing matches with Dominic Reyes and Thiago Santos. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say struggle. I would say that those fights were very nip-tuck. They were very close. And mm-hmm. many scorers at home and cage side had the others.
I thought he lost both of them, actually, in the moment. So.
Yeah, I've heard many very seasoned MMA fans and journalists say that they thought Jones lost at least one or two of those fights. I think for him, a key number with striking has something to do with his takedown success. I think his work to the body and the legs is good, but I think he was severely lacking in his body, with head strikes in those fights. He was a little more efficient than both in both fights, but against Reyes and Santos, he threw 95 fewer and 60 fewer significant strike attempts to the head. Mm. Now, I think that lack of work up top, I think that doesn't lend itself to his opponents respecting his wrestling ability anymore. I think if he could find his way back to a higher strike output, at least toward the head, he might be able to find his takedowns as well. I think that's how Jones primarily has been acting in his recent years as a fighter. I think that well-roundedness is what makes him special. Mm-hmm. He isn't a big one-punch guy. He isn't primarily ground and pounder, although he had a lot of success with that pretty early on. I think he, better than anybody, puts it all together. And I don't think he's put it all together in those recent fights, save for the Gane fight, which was over in mere moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super interesting. And yeah, obviously it spreads over a long time too, right? These fights we're referencing, it's over like a 5-year period and now two weight classes. The head strikes is definitely, I think, one of the key elements of this fight, right? Because I don't think John will even say himself that, you know, he's not a big one punch knockout guy. He's never mm-hmm. been, no one's ever really given him that label. The times he has hurt guys with big strikes, you know, Daniel Cormier, obviously a kick, things like that. And Stipe Miocic, that's where he, you know, does his best work, right? It's like headshots and the power there is more proven. We don't know with the time off what Stipe has been doing. It sounds like what I hear behind the scenes, like he has put in the right training, he's bringing in the right people, like he's done all this right and he's been looking good. I don't know how that translates at his age, but when you look at like paths to success here for Stipe and how he can counter things from John, is it his boxing success and the takedown defense that you think keeps him on track if he does find success in this fight?
Yeah, I'd have to point toward Miocic landing good head shots, but also keeping it, keeping a good head, body, and leg clip, not becoming a headhunter. Mm. And then also takedown defense, of course. You don't want to be on your back against Jones. He can pass on you. He can land significant strikes on the ground like few have ever done. And I think that Miocic wants to keep this fight standing. I think he'll definitely have a power edge there. And I think that if he lands early, he could at least, if not knock Jones out, he can sway judges into giving him rounds, maybe not based on volume, but based on power.
Mm. Yeah. Is there any value in Stipe trying to grapple at all in this fight, offensively grapple? I mean, we know John Jones's takedown defense is pretty much ironclad for his entire career. He held that record for years, and then I think finally someone got one on him, but it didn't really mean anything. Is there any, if you're Stipe's team, do you put any time or investment into like maybe just see what happens if we can get him on his back?
Yeah, I think you have to think about everything when you fight John Jones. You can't become a one-trick pony who just wants to throw jabs and crosses. If you find yourself in a good clinch position, see where you can go. See if you can get a good trip or something going. Mm-hmm. Or if you can time a single or something, go for it. Or double. I don't think that there should be a game plan, but I don't think that Miocic and his corner should limit him in any way. I think he's too good. He's a really talented fighter. He's arguably one of the greatest heavyweights, if not the greatest heavyweight in UFC history, perhaps all of MMA, a lot of people might argue. I say lean on your skills. If you can see, if you see something open, go for it.
Yeah, definitely agree. That would be extremely interesting if you got, you know, top position on John. We haven't seen that pretty much at all. But you mentioned, you know, kind of the history here for Stipe. If he wins this, three-time heavyweight champion, and we've only seen a three-time divisional champion once. It was in this weight class with Randy Couture. Israel Adesanya failed to do that by beating Dricus du Plessis, but this doesn't come around very often. What's your siding on the argument of, like, you know, it's very impressive to reclimb twice, but that also means you've lost the belt twice, and maybe people look at that as like a hit on your legacy of sort. Do you think, like, it means more to me as seeing the sport unfold for so many years and how hard it is to reclaim a title, especially if it's not in like an immediate rematch situation that we see sometimes. I know that's how Stipe got his second reign, but what's your thoughts on kind of that argument?
I'm all for giving someone their flowers when they're able to hoist gold over their belt after a fight. I think if you do it three different times against three different people in three different eras, I'm not sure it really matters to me. I'm impressed. And if Miocic would to become the latest or at least the second heavyweight to do so after Randy Couture, who's a Hall of Famer, I think that only secures Stipe's Hall of Fame credentials going forward.
Mm-hmm. And we know John's already guaranteed to be a Hall of Famer. He was before he came to heavyweight, but he would be in this elite group now to have title defenses in two divisions. We know there's a big group of fighters who have, you know, won the belt nine now in two weight classes, but to do it as one who would defend, that would obviously be another feather in his cap with the legacy, and then bring him to 16 total UFC title fight wins, which is just remarkable. And it's the one that he's waving around in everyone's face, right? That's like his final card, where if you get in an argument with him, we're seeing it with Tom Aspinall, you see it with Megamed Ankalaev, the little thing like, just break my records, bro. Like, that's his final ace card that he plays in the hand, because it's a good one. 16 title fight wins.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone's ever going to touch that record. I mean, I was looking at the top 10 just today, and the closest fighters who are active are Shevchenko with 9, Aldo with 8, and Adesanya with 8. Wow. And while Shevchenko is an active champion, she's got a lot of work to do to catch up to John Jones. Aldo isn't a champion right now, and Adesanya has a bit of work to do to get back into the championship rankings of that division as well. So, yeah, that looks like something Jones is going to hold on to for quite a while.
Yeah, and especially on the male side, what Amanda Nunes is at, like 12 or something? Obviously, she's retired, but there's talk of her maybe coming back. But I can't imagine a world where she fights four more times. I think if she comes back, it's going to be, you know, one, max two.
Yeah, she seems like a pretty happy mama bear. I think she might come back for, you know, the right opportunity, the right timing. But yeah, it would be tough to imagine her coming back for four or five more fights, not to mention holding the belt and keeping it for that long too. Great champion, great fighter, but tough to do, you know, toward the end of your career.
Mm-hmm. Any last kind of talking points on Jones versus Miocic that you wanted to hit on, or anything we didn't reach that you think is kind of pivotal towards the analysis or just context of this fight?
I think we're pretty good on Jones and Miocic. I can't wait for the fight to actually happen. I'm so excited that it's finally here. I really am. It'll answer a lot of questions, I think. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine the fight being a snoozer. I think this is going to be a pretty good one.
Yeah, especially, I mean, the whole element of this whole thing, it's so weird this week, right? Because in one side, like, it should be a celebration of John Jones. Like, if he had said, this is my retirement fight, I'm doing it in New York where I've never fought, the state I was born in, like, you know, I'm going to be doing all these things for the final time. I think the tone on this whole week would be so different. But for him to be like, well, I might retire, I'm not fighting Tom Aspinall, but I'll fight Alex Pereira. Like, there's just a lot of weird things. Does that take any of like the luster off this week, just not knowing the direction? Or I know you love the chaos of MMA, so does like the uncertainty of this whole thing make it more entertaining for you?
I mean, I just think Jones is probably trolling us. If, you know, when he says he's not going to fight Aspinall next, because I guess Aspinall doesn't have enough credentials for him. I mean, Jones talked about a move up to heavyweight for quite a long time, and to finally get there and then say, no, I'm not going to fight a heavyweight. I'm going to fight a light heavyweight slash middleweight, and he might come up to heavyweight to fight me. I don't know if I really see the point in that. I think Jones is a smart enough guy to not really see a point in that either. If Jones wanted to go back to light heavyweight, I could kind of see that if heavyweight didn't seem to have much for him in the future. But I don't know. I think he'll fight Tom Aspinall if Aspinall remains the number one contender going forward.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds. I know Tom plans on making his presence known throughout the week in however format they may be. So see if he can poke the bear. Jones said in one of these interviews that he is annoyed by him, which I was a little surprised to hear him say like outright in that word. So if you're Tom, I guess just keep doing what you're doing maybe. I agree on like the whole Alex Pereira part. I mean, the only way I'd want to see, I think if John isn't going to fight Tom, he needs to vacate the title after this and give Tom his rightful opportunity to be the full champion, do whatever. But if he's going to fight Alex Pereira, I only want to see it if it's for the heavyweight title, because then you're having Alex Pereira come up and do the three division champ thing, which would be never done before. Mm-hmm. Jones versus Pereira, just as a normal fight without a belt on the line at heavyweight. Like obviously if Pereira can win, it would be huge, but that doesn't really do it for me. Yeah. And especially if you're the UFC, like why, we're gonna let Jones destroy our next big star here and then retire, and then what does Alex do? He's just lost his luster and all that. So I don't know, it's a weird situation. That's I think what I'm most excited for this whole thing to kind of unfold and see what we're actually going to get. But if it is John Jones' last fight week, it would be nice to know that we can actually embrace it even more.
Yeah, and it being at MSG, you're right, it would be nice to be able to give him his flowers and heraldry this week and really build this up as perhaps Jones' last fight. And that's why I kind of feel like it's not going to be. I think he's still got at least one or two more fights in him. Not necessarily physically wise. I think he could fight for quite a while if he wanted to. But I think, you know, he has to ask himself how much more does he want to accomplish and how much more risk does he want to take giving to his body before he can walk away from the sport relatively healthy and unscathed. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think we'll see him after this week.
Yeah. And you mentioned, I guess, just last thing on this before we move on, the physical part. He did say in an interview, which I thought was very intriguing, that he's lost like noticeable power after in his upper body after the shoulder and the elbow surgeries, which you don't hear a fighter say that. He thinks he's still very strong, he said, and makes up for it the other ways. But it seems somewhere in the back of his mind the effects of those surgeries is there for him, and they weren't, you know, unsubstantial surgeries. He's been away for a year, he got his whole stuff redone, so you have to wonder about that part too.
Yeah, I think for him to go public with that and say that to someone means that it's something he thinks about all the time. Mm-hmm. For that to spill over the top, so to speak. That'll be interesting to see if his physicality is where we expect it to be, especially at heavyweight, especially fighting a bigger, stronger person.
Yeah. Yeah. And those New York commissioners better let him tape those damn toes, because he won't make the walk otherwise. That's what he said at the last press conference. He's like, I'm giving a heads up to all you guys. Like, I tape my toes or I don't step in that cage. So I know there was some drama there last time, but yeah, he's definitely got his wear and tear, which I mean, makes the fact that he's done what he's done so incredible, let alone all the other stuff he's done to his body that does not need to be mentioned. So pretty crazy stuff with John Jones. He is, of course, one of a kind, very unique, my goat, and he can enhance it this weekend. But I don't think Stipe Miocic is this this dead body just being dragged into the cage that some people are making it out to be.
No, I don't think so. I mean, whether the time off affects him or not, we really can't tell right now. But what you said, that his training camp is that got him really peaking and focusing on the right things, I think we're going to get a really good earnest effort from a former heavyweight great. I think he's too proud to put himself out there and not show something to the people. I don't think he would stick around too long unless he really knew he had something to provide in the fight.
Mm-hmm. And I hope that happens. I hope even if he loses in the first round, I hope the minutes leading up to it are like competitive and he shows something, just so people don't completely, you know, drag on this whole situation even more. But nevertheless, yeah. One thing that will have no negativity around it is a Michael Chandler fight, because this is the most positive man you will find in the sport. Man, like, don't need to go back and recount all the Conor McGregor stuff. That's been done. Bummer for him. He took the risk. It didn't work out. But for him, he says that these 2 years he's been working diligently and he's like a different fighter than he was before. You know, fighters will say that it's hard to reinvent yourself completely at 37 years old like he is. But if you look at Michael Chandler's first five UFC fights and he says he's reviewed the tape, he's made these drastic changes, what do you think would be the biggest asset in his game to make adjustments to going into these fights? Is it just striking defense?
Move your head. Yeah. And don't get into a firefight if you don't have to. You know, he can be a tactician. He's got skill. He isn't just simply a brawler in there, but sometimes though he seems to lose track of the game plan or what's best for him. He's got a 0-3 knockdown ratio in his losses in the UFC, and he's got 2-0 in his wins. It's sometimes just as simple as that. Don't get clipped. Don't get knocked down. Charles Oliveira, while a very dangerous fighter in practically every way you can think of, is not somebody who I classically think wins rounds a lot. He finds some way to finish you, and things are over before you thought they had begun. But he doesn't go out there and kickboxes for three rounds and grits out decisions or does the same with wrestling. Mm-hmm. I think Michael Chandler can do that, but he can also finish you. So if Michael Chandler sticks to a game plan that keeps him safe, and I don't mean boring, I don't mean, you know, wrestle heavy necessarily, but something that minimizes a little bit of risk, he can get his hand raised. He can get his hand raised against anybody, I think. He's a super talented guy.
Yeah, he does. He's a coin flip when he goes in there. And that's the one thing, like, you know, I've criticized him in the past, just being like, he should win most of these fights, but he seems to make, you know, poor fight IQ choices and things like that seem to really cost him. But the 5-round element of this, I want to say favors him, but I'm not really sure. I can't imagine this one goes 5, just given the way these two go together. But yeah, like a long layoff at his age. But he's got to have all the motivation here. I mean, he's already fought this guy. He had major success against Charles Oliveira when they fought. So yeah, like I don't really know what to think of Michael Chandler here. Like, he seems to be doing everything right. He looks in ridiculous shape as always, and this is a hugely important fight for him, but just anything that's not Conor McGregor, I just imagine where his mindset's at and the work it's taken to shift focus.
I think he knows he has some work to do. 2-3 in the UFC isn't going to cut it. And excuse me, because I'm going to be around for many more 5-round fights, whether it's a co-main or the main event or a title fight, unless he starts racking up a couple of these big wins. And I think he realizes this is his opportunity to make his presence felt once again in the division. We'll see, though. He's fighting one of the trickiest outs in UFC history, as far as I'm concerned. Somebody who's only gotten better and better. A talented guy in Charles Oliveira, who started off with some flashy wins, some pretty flashy losses. Mm-hmm. And then it seems at some point along the way he found himself. And he started stringing together not only some good wins against average UFC talent, but then he started to finish guys who were in the top 15, top 10, top 5. And became a champion and proved that he belongs amongst the elite, if not the division, maybe the UFC history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, one of the all-time greats. I mean, I read some of his records off the top. He's got many, many more. I mean, from the unique to the unorthodox to just the uncommon, all these different things. What is your favorite Charles Oliveira statistic, would you say? Because he's got so many of them.
It has nothing to do with strikes or takedowns or button pushing or anything like that. It's 19 bonuses, yeah. More than anybody in UFC history. It's just a testament to how exciting this guy is. Win or lose, finish or decision. Every time he goes out there and fights, you can't miss it. He's just one of a handful of fighters that you really never want to miss. 19 bonuses is crazy. I mean, 3 fight of the nights. Fight of the nights, usually we give those out to fights that go the distance, things that are sort of back and forth affairs. There aren't many of those in his career because he generally finishes opponents. Mm-hmm. 13 performance awards and 3 submissions of the night, if you're OG enough to remember those days.
Yeah.
19. It's unbelievable. He's always fun to watch.
Yeah, he's one of the greats. 13 performance bonuses is absolutely insane and just goes to show that he's usually the hammer in there, but he's been the nail and he's come back. You know, I think we're a little bit past the Charles Oliveira phase of he quits and fights and things like that. I think that's been disproven given his title reign and all that stuff after. But since coming back to lightweight, he's not lost 2 in a row here, and he's kind of got a little bit of back against the wall, but he obviously lost the last one against Armin Sarukian at UFC 300. I don't know. Do you think that brings anything out of him, especially fighting a guy he's already beat? That's got to at least give you a lot of confidence in the ability to rebound, I think.
Well, not being a fighter myself or an athlete, I've always heard that when you fight somebody you've already beaten or play a team you've already beaten, you do have the confidence that you can do it because you've proved it. Mm-hmm. But you might also lack the motivation to do it again because you kind of ask yourself, well, what do I have to do differently this time? Because my opponent's definitely going to do something differently if they know what's best for them. So I don't know if Oliveira, I can't get into his mind about it. I don't know if he is psyched for this fight, so to speak, but we'll see. I don't really honestly see him going out there and laying an egg. I can't remember the last time he really ever did it. And again, like in his early days when he was far more reckless and still exciting and dangerous, but more reckless, you know, he might go out there and make a pivotal mistake, or that immaturity you kind of alluded to earlier when he would go out there and either lose, you know, his gas tank or his will to really want to battle back. I don't know. I don't think that's not who this guy is anymore. And I think he's certainly proven that.
Yeah, for sure. My favorite Charles Oliveira statistic is he has the most submission wins in featherweight history, and he hasn't fought there in about like 7 years or something like that, which I don't know if that says more about the amazing things he did there or just the lack of submission success by a single person in featherweight since then. There hasn't been a really guy who's taken that, but I always look at that. I'm like, this man has the most featherweight submission wins, and it's just been another year since he hasn't fought there.
Yeah. I think Uriah Faber was in a similar situation for a while too.
Yeah.
Where he had some featherweight number, and then he went to bantamweight and then took that number too. So he had it at both divisions or something like that. I think it was Uriah. Yeah, that's pretty funny. I think I give more credit to Oliveira for being outstanding than I would demote the featherweights for their lack of grappling.
Okay,
there are plenty of good featherweight grapplers.
Yeah, there is. Who is more? Which Iron Mike is more likely to get a knockout this weekend? You think Iron Mike Chandler or Iron Mike Tyson?
Oh, man. I don't know. How old is Mike Tyson now? Is he 60?
58.
58. And would you say a youthful 58? I might argue you would not.
I don't know.
Mike Tyson has forgot more about boxing than his opponent has learned, but that doesn't mean that that Paul isn't a young, spry, capable, and powerful guy, because he is.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I would give the nod to Iron Mike Chandler as being a greater chance of getting a knockout this weekend. Okay. And the other fight makes me sad, and I don't really want to think about it.
Yeah, no, I know. We won't touch on that too much today. I will be watching that one through my fingers, probably somewhere on my iPhone on Netflix on Friday. I'm not doing a whole appointment watch party type of thing. But
how big of a favorite is Paul? I assume he's the favorite.
Yeah, I think. Let's see.
Is it enormous?
Odds right now, he is looking like -260, Mike Tyson +200. So
okay.
It's not... not terrible. I thought it would be crazier than that.
Yeah, it's not a laugher. Mm-hmm. I don't know what other odds have looked like for Paul fights, because every time he seems to fight somebody, it's kind of like this weird matchup you never imagined before against someone who doesn't fight anymore or is fighting out of their major discipline. And you just go, I don't know how to make odds for this. So we're just going to take a stab in the dark here. And -260 is a respectable number for Iron Mike Tyson. We'll see.
I mean, we'll put it this way, and this is no shade at UFC 309, but he is a smaller underdog than anyone on the main card of this pay-per-view on Saturday, UFC 309, which is kind of crazy. The smallest dog is +215, Viviane Araújo, and then the rest, we got some wide odds. James Lintop against Mauricio Rufi, +600. Paul Craig against Bo Nickel, +775. Chandler, +215, and Stipe, +500 is the time of this recording. So those are... could be a lopsided main card if the odds stack up to this, but I don't know. It doesn't feel that way to me. I don't know.
Do you think they build cards that way on purpose? So they kind of build in quote unquote action, meaning we think we're going to get some finishes dialed up here just by the matchmaking.
I wouldn't hate that thought. I mean, given the way some pay-per-views have gone in recent months or throughout this year, I think it's not the worst idea. I mean, I was a little surprised they bumped Chris Weidman off the main card into the prelims, given it could be his retirement fight, New York, all that stuff. But maybe he would prefer to be tucked away because he's had rotten luck on these MSG cards. So
that's
maybe
true.
He prefers that. But yeah, I mean, in terms of that, who knows? I mean, that's definitely what they're setting the stage for, seemingly. But I think those main and co-main events may be a little more competitive. I don't know. Do you think, is Mauricio Rufi good enough with that UFC debut to warrant a -900? I know we're getting a little off track here, but...
I don't really know gambling odds too well. I don't really ever discuss them, but I do know that giving an enormous number to a newcomer or relative newcomer, that sounds dangerous to me if I'm putting money on that guy. We'll see if his opponent has much to say about it, but yeah, -900 for a one fight UFC vet. That says a lot about what odds makers think of his overall talent though. So Maybe this is another coming out party, putting him on the main card instead of, you know, a former champion like Chris Weidman. Yeah. Maybe that's where the UFC wants to put their focus on these new young killers.
Yeah, there's always a method to the madness with this. So I trust what Sean and Mick and Hunter and Dana end up doing with this fight order placement. But before we get you out of here, another fight I wanted to touch on at UFC 309, just because we always need to give Jim Miller his flowers. He's fighting on the prelims of this card. Obviously, the UFC 300 thing didn't, you know, wasn't his dream scenario playing out in real life, but he fought on that card, achieved that moment, and he's continuing to do it. That wasn't the retirement. Here he is welcoming Damon Jackson back to lightweight for the first time. I think this is his UFC debut. Then he's been a featherweight ever since then. I mean, I guess just marvel at Jim Miller from a statistical perspective for a few moments. We know this man has the most fights and the most wins of all time. Are you surprised that he's continuing to keep ticking here?
Well, in a way, yes, because he's sort of breaking the mold of what we think of fighters who are in their 40s. Fighters who have fought a long time and very well and earned finishes, they tend to fade toward the end of their career, and they don't pile up any more knockouts and submissions. They often just lose decisions and look a little lackluster in them. I won't name names or anything, but Jim Miller's not doing that. He's a viable fighter in every fight he's in, save for maybe one mismatch or two where it just wasn't his night. He's still finishing fighters and still looking like he's got an all-around skill set that he's been working on tirelessly since he began. It's pretty great.
Yeah, no, he's remarkable. He's one of a kind. I know like the 300 thing was a big milestone for him, and then he kind of has started to reassess the goals again. I'm curious to see what he says this week as we chat more with him, but you kind of look at his resume and that 50 UFC fight marker isn't terribly far away, six away, and then he only needs a few more to get to 30 wins in the UFC. Do you think he hits one of those, both of those, none of those? What's your gut say?
I have a feeling that the fights and the wins will come in one and the same. I think matchmaking going forward, I don't think we're going to give Jim Miller, you know, any top five fights or anything like that. And a fair number of his recent wins have come over fighters who were late replacements like Jesse Butler, Nicholas Mata, Eric Gonzalez. And while you can put a young fighter in there who's green but eager and they can finish anybody, Jim Miller dusted all three of them. And he's not going away. So I think if you give him more fights and if he can remain relatively healthy at his age, I think he's 41 now. That's probably going to be the hardest part, is just not, you know, having some sort of training injury or something like that that keeps him out of time. He's always been a pretty active fighter. I think he could do it. I wouldn't put money against him, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely in play. I know, you know, Cerrone wants to come back. He said the 50 fights thing, but I don't think he realizes his WEC fights don't actually count. Jim Miller is the true leader in that category. Last fun thing I wanted to ask you, Mike, before I let you out of here, since we've done so much statistical talk today and there's, you know, so many records, I'm sure we'll talk many more times in the future about them coming up on the show. But what, in your opinion, whether it's something we talked about from this card or another obscure stat or otherwise, is the most unbreakable UFC record?
Well, I mentioned earlier, John Jones's title fight wins at 15 right now, could be 16 this weekend as one. I think, though, the first thing that came to mind when we thought about this question was Max Holloway and his significant strikes landed. He's at 3,457. Now, to put that number in context, the guy in second place, Sean Strickland, is at 2,069. Max has almost 1,400 more than the second place fighter, which is an enormous gulf. And I don't think someone's going to catch up to him unless the structure of the UFC event planning changes and fighters fight more often. I think, because going back to Max's early days, he had three different years where he fought four times. I don't know how many fighters we're going to get this year that get four fights, and he did it three times in a calendar year. And he was super busy in all of those fights. After his fourth fight in the UFC, I think it was against Leonard Garcia, I said to a couple of buddies, my work buddies, I said, I think this guy's going to be the future. And I wasn't like trying to be some genius or something about it, but I thought, this guy's going to probably own every strike record imaginable, because after just four fights, he already landed the fifth and sixth most significant strikes in a featherweight fight. That was two out of his four fights, and he's already in the top 10 record books for this division. I'm like, okay, that's a pretty hot start. Let's see where he ends. And now he's in pole position. He's, again, what was it? Almost 1,400 more than second place for UFC history. It's unbelievable. And if you want to look at the top 10 in the category, you've got Andrade, Poirier, RDA, Green, and Angela Hill. Those are mostly fighters who are kind of winding down their careers. I don't think they're going to be around much longer. And Sean Strickland is really the only other guy who remains active. And he is what you would consider a championship caliber fight. Not only was he the champion, but he's going to be in main events. He's going to be on main cards for the rest of his career. Mm-hmm. Those guys don't fight that often. And I don't think Sean Strickland has enough fight time or age left to catch up with someone like Max Holloway, who is, by the way, younger than Sean Strickland.
And intends and continuing to fight for the foreseeable future. I mean, I'll never forget the first time I brought up the statistical or significant strike statistic to Max Holloway before his fight with Calvin Kattar, I believe. So he added a ton more on that. And I think he was the first person to break 2K at that time. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I want to be the first to 10K. Like, you're going to call me 10K Holloway. I don't think that's going to happen. He'd need, you know, many, many more fights. I don't think he has another 30 UFC fights in him, but you can tell like where his mindset is. And he seems to know that this is a very unique and important part of his game.
Yeah. I don't know if we'll ever see him in a 3-round fight again. Mm. Even if he's moving up to lightweight, you'd probably put him in a main event right away, right?
Another one of these 5-round co-mains that they do now.
Yeah. So he's going to have the time. And his fights tend to go longer because he's not like a big one-punch KO guy, although he can do that, but mm-hmm. that's not his style. I think he can accumulate an enormous beatdown on just about anybody he fights. I think that skill is going to be with him for quite a while until he doesn't want to do it anymore. Yeah. And if he wants to get to 10,000, holy, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if anyone's going to get that far. I don't think you could fight that long. But I mean, if he's at 34.57 right now, he could get to 5K. I could see that happening. If he I don't know what his sparring style is like. I don't know if he takes a lot when he trains. You probably know.
So he went that stretch for a long time. They're like, after all that stuff happened with, you know, the Brian Ortega fight being canceled on fight week and like the health mm-hmm. issues he's going through, I think he really pulled back on sparring and didn't do it for several years. And I think he said that's like what brought out that crazy performance against Calvin Kattar as well, like all those pent up non-sparring times. But he said he brought it back for the Gaethje fight because he's like, this guy is so scary. And then he did some for Ilya as well. So yeah, he took a few years off there, which is something I know Robbie Lawler did in like mm-hmm. kind of the championship, slight post-championship run of his career in the UFC. And then he brought it back towards the end as well. So I don't know. I mean, these are guys with very high impact styles and things like that. So I'm sure over time it's got there, especially if you're a Robbie Lawler who has probably done more sparring than anyone needs for a lifetime in the Miletic days and things like that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, wisdom comes with age, you know, and Holloway started with the UFC at such a young age. I think he did what worked for him for quite a while. And I think he has wised up to the point where he realizes he may need to change up his approach to every opponent, you know, whether he's fighting somebody who's more of a brawling style like Gaethje or Michael Chandler, or somebody who wants to keep things a little more conservative. So yeah, that's interesting. I think I'm excited to see what happens with him at lightweight, because I think he could really make a run there too. I don't know how much that cut was killing him, but it always looked like it took its toll. So we'll see what he does at lightweight.
Absolutely. I can't wait for his announcement, whenever that may come of the fight. And I guess in relation to another unbreakable statistic, I guess he kind of has maybe another one too. I don't know how many people are going to make it 29 fights without being knocked down or knocked out. So whatever you think of the 301, 28, 29, whatever, but it's definitively over now. And yeah, there's not many guys there. I know Jones is hanging around, but I can't imagine him fighting 5 or 6 more times. So
yeah,
I guess that's a perfect way to put a bow on this. We started with John Jones. We'll end with John Jones. Michael, I appreciate you being here on the Bonfire so much for the very first time. Really enjoyed this chat. Hope all you stat heads out there liked it too, and I hope to do this many more times. We'll take a quick break and be here to wrap things up. And that does it for this UFC 309 Fight Week edition of the Bonfire. I will be in New York for MMA Junkie covering this event, and it should be a lot of fun as always. Media day on Wednesday, press conference on Thursday, official and ceremonial lands on Friday, then of course the fights on Saturday. Will this be the last John Jones fight week I ever cover? It might just be. And if so, it's kind of crazy to reflect back on this image from 12 years ago, the first John Jones fight week I covered. If we could do a little throwback moment here, that was just down the street. here in Toronto prior to UFC 165, where he fought Alexander Gustafsson in their all-time UFC Hall of Fame fight. It's been a wild, entertaining, and oftentimes tumultuous journey with John Jones since then. And even though there's a lot of mixed feelings about this fight against Miocic and the situation with Tom Aspinall, I think it's important that we keep in mind this could be his last fight week for one of the GOATs, in my mind, the GOAT of our sport, and seeing him what he does best one last time. I will be back next week with another episode of The Bonfire to reflect and digest it all at UFC 309, see what's going on going forward. Thanks so much to the great Kamikaze for producing the program, and I'll talk to you all next week.